This is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. As Hawaii County Mayor Harry Kim seeks to find a solution to the impasse on Mauna Kea, supporters of the beleaguered 30-minute telescope project rallied in Honolulu. HPR's Ryan Finnerty was there and joins us in the studio. Morning.
Morning, Catherine. Yeah, so yesterday on Thursday, Mayor Harry Kim of Hawaii County put out a statement clarifying his role in responding to the situation on Mauna Kea. And then for those who might have missed that, Governor David Ige designated Mayor Kim as his representative on Hawaii Island for Mauna Kea-related issues. That happened earlier this week. And there was kind of some uncertainty about what that actually meant, what his powers were. And so the mayor clarified it in a statement, and he said that he has no authority to intervene or make any kind of deal regarding TMT, but that his role is to work with all sides to find a better way forward. And he expressed in that statement his wish to get the parties to find common ground and achieve a peaceful resolution to the dispute, which is a stance that's been echoed by Governor David Ige. Mayor Kim said that his first task or his first priority was to ensure the safe flow of traffic on Daniel K. Inouye Highway, also known as Saddle Road, which was closed at one point last week briefly because of some blockages related to the demonstration. Here on Oahu, there were two rallies held last night at the state capitol, the one in favor of the TMT and one against. The pro-TMT rally had been in the works for a couple weeks, and when opponents of the project got wind of that, they organized their own counter-demonstration in response. The two sides ended up across the street from each other, across Baratania Street, one in front of the state capitol, the other across the street. And since I had spent all of last week on Mauna Kea with opponents of the TMT, I wanted to go to the pro rally and hear from some of the supporters and kind of get their thoughts on the project and why they felt the way they do. That rally was organized by Samuel Wilder King II. If that name sounds familiar to anybody, you might have seen it on the ballot box. King was a candidate for the Office of Hawaiian Affairs in the last election, which he was not successful in campaigning for that office. His day job is as an attorney in Honolulu, and he told me that he thinks the TMT's search for knowledge is a natural extension of the Hawaiian tradition of discovery and exploration.
And that's why I want to be here. I want people to know, like, I don't want them to run scared. I want them to see the Native Hawaiians are here, the people of Hawaii are here. The protesters don't own our story. We can tell our own story, and it's okay to come out and be in favor of this. It's not a desecration. It's not the oppression of the Hawaiian people. We want it. We love this. We think it's great. We think it's going to help us a lot. We think there's other issues we need to address. I mean, I've been trying to talk about, you know, the corruption at OHA. They've been trying to audit OHA and say, like, we got to fix these things. I agree. I think DHHL should be building more homes. Let's start doing it right. I think that's the issue to discuss. But stopping the telescope that's got all the money coming in and bringing us millions of dollars, what's the point? Like, OHA's going to get 20% of the money. So what was the point? What are we, we're just going to lose. What does the day after tomorrow look like? Right. We just have nothing. We got no more money. Nobody wants to come here. No top grade science. We're the best place on earth to do this science for the Northern Hemisphere. We're just going to stop.
That was Samuel Wilder King II, former candidate for OHA, and organizer of the pro-TMT rally at the state capitol last night, explaining his support. That 20% he mentioned, Catherine, is a nod to the law, state law that any state agency that generates revenue from the leasing of the ceded lands, or crown lands as they're sometimes called, does send 20% of that revenue to OHA. That figure is actually capped, though, by state law. So there's some debate as to, you know, how much of this particular project's revenue OHA would get. But the TMT organization has been paying for their lease already. That already started. King there kind of expressing, trying to shift the discussion away from the telescope and saying that even if we stop this, it's not going to solve all of these other problems that exist. And as he mentioned, he's been a big champion for reform at OHA and some of the other departments that deal with Hawaiian issues. There were some plenty of other supporters there, about 300 on the supporting side. Another Hawaiian supporter of the project that I talked to is Malia Martin. She is the organizer and founder of a group called Imua TMT. They're a pro-astronomy community group. And she reiterated her strong support, as King did, for the project, and went on to say that she thinks the two sides can find common ground.
Both sides want Mauna Kea to be managed better. The Rock just invited the whole world to go visit Mauna Kea, so if it's not managed well, it's going to end up crowded like Diamond Head or Hanama Bay or Makapu Point Trail. So it has to be managed better. We both sides agree on that.
And that was Malia Martin, organizer of the community group Imua TMT, a pro-TMT group, pro-astronomy group, expressing her desire to find common ground with opponents of the project over better management practices of the mountain. There were a lot of other supporters there. Education was a big theme that I heard a lot about. One woman I spoke with grew up in Hilo, and she was inspired to pursue STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and math, after being influenced by astronomy growing up in Hilo. And she now works on Mauna Kea after studying physics and astronomy. So a lot of stories like that. Another woman I spoke with was a career educator, and she said that she really thinks these are the types of opportunities Hawaii needs to pursue in order to stop the, you know, brain drain or the flight to the mainland of children.
I did hear some of the folks that were out there said, you know, we can speak freely here at this demonstration, at this show of support, but there were other folks that maybe were intimidated, folks like UH Hilo, that while they supported the project, were just afraid to be vocal about it.
Yeah, that was a common thing that I heard. A few people kind of expressed some thoughts on why that might be. They do, whether it's true or not, the supporters do view themselves as sort of the silent majority. There is some polling data from that was commissioned by the Star Advertiser last year that supports that conclusion, but a lot of the opponents kind of have written off that poll as not being accurate or not being representative. But that was a common thread that, they do feel like they've been shouted down, particularly Native Hawaiians who support the telescope have felt like there wasn't really a venue for them to express those views, and that was one of the reasons that this rally was called.
It would be interesting to see if someone comes up with another survey just to kind of test the waters and see, you know, where the sentiment sits.
It would be. My sense of the situation is that a lot of people have kind of made up their minds already, and each side will find a reason to accept or write off any kind of data like that, whether it supports their position or not. So not sure how useful it would be, but for maybe those folks in the middle who haven't decided, it might be enlightening.
Yeah, and we'll see what happens in the weeks to come.
That's right.
All right, thanks so much, Ryan. And you know, we did hear from the community on our talkback line on this issue. Here's former Windward Oahu Senator Pohai Ryan.
I experienced both cultural and summit tour to the summit. And I do want people to know that there has been concern about the overdevelopment of the summit since 1976. There's documentation that has been out on Facebook. It also should be noted that the governor, George Ariyoshi, at the time was very concerned about that. There was an original agreement when it first started to allow only a certain amount of observatories, which has been exceeded by far since. The real issue here is about management, breach of trust for the community after voicing concerns, and it goes on deaf ears. Definitely the construction of vacant buildings should happen, but should happen immediately, should not be delayed anymore if you want to rebuild trust with the Hawaiian community. I do think that there is hope to get us to a place where the whole community can have some consensus. TMT is not the demon here, but unfortunately they are part of the collateral damage, and it's a matter of timing, and it's not unique to this situation. The LNR, University of Hawaii, needs to take great care in what they do, and UH, quite frankly, has been very poor stewards.
Share your feedback with us by emailing at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Reach out via social media on Facebook or Twitter, or call our talkback line 792-8217.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the Asia Pacific Dance Festival's Ikehana One and Culinary Celebration with dancers from Canada's First Nations, Malaysia, and Hawaii, August 3rd. outreach.hawaii.edu/APDF.
Saturday, July 27th in HPR's Atherton Studio. If the Ronettes had a time machine, this is what they would sound like. Join us for a night of infectious energy and danceable grooves with The Elevations, an 8-piece vintage soul band. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org or call the station during business hours. Sponsored by Amoresco.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your Aloha Friday quiz. Today, we've got a lot of hot air to blow off, or at least blow into a balloon. Some still love the antiquated craft and say it's an underrated, if cumbersome, means of air travel. The first hot air balloon flights in Hawaii were unmanned, and it's probably just as well. The first recorded flight took place off Hilo in 1825 when the British warship Blonde set off a paper air balloon that almost immediately caught fire and nearly destroyed a grass house on the shore. 15 years later, one Hannah Holmes launched an unmanned hot air balloon on Oahu, delighting 60 visiting American military officers. Our backyard quiz for today is, when was the first successful manned hot air balloon? Call 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right gets a reusable tote bag that tells people you got it right.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors Locations, Haleakala Waldorf School, and Honolulu Waldorf School.
The death toll for related traffic deaths in Maui rose to 14 last week. That's up from 10 the same time last year. As the Valley Isle looks to rein in fatalities on the road, officials are looking to roll out programs designed to deter unsafe practices and make Hawaii's roads safer. Among Maui's most ambitious public works program is Vision Zero, an initiative that Mayor Mike Victorino hopes will prevent all traffic-related deaths and serious injuries on the island. HPR was able to talk with Mayor Victorino on the matter. Here's what he had to say.
I'm appalled at the fact that we've had 14 fatalities this year compared to 10 last year. But the comparison is not what I'm referring to. It's just the aspect that many of these fatalities could have been prevented. Last one, as we may be well aware of, is that alcohol was involved. Driving drunk or driving intoxicated is something I will not tolerate. For myself, back in 1989, I had a drunk driver slam into me and my family, my son and his friend. And I spent 6 months recuperating until today, still suffer from back problems from that accident. The bad thing is that guy had no insurance and was actually driving a truck that belonged to a family member who had no insurance, and the family member claimed that he had taken the car without their permission. It was a mess. And so I know firsthand what people suffer through when a impaired driver runs into them. Now, it's not only impaired and drunk and those areas, also inattention. You know, not paying attention, texting while you're driving, on your cell phone while you're driving, absolutely a no-no. I just ask the public each and every time I have my radio program, which is once a week, just to be cognizant, to be respectful, to be aware of what's around you. Drive defensively. And please, if you're impaired, drunk, drugs, whatever it might be, you know, just go to a doctor and he gives you some medicine that may impair your driving. Don't drive. We've got Uber, we've got Lyft, we've got taxis. You got family and friends that will pick you up. Don't drive impaired. We started a pilot program. It's a pilot project, and our first one will be on Kanaloa Avenue, fronting the War Memorial Sports Complex. And the nice thing about it is the state has done that around the state on state roadways and state highways, and I believe people slow down when they see it. I do. And I know I've had complaints, people saying they feel like it impairs them because the lanes are too narrow between the barriers and the actual drive space through that area. But it makes people aware there's a crosswalk and that pedestrians are crossing and that will slow them down. I'm all for it. So we're going to see how that works here. We're also working on a program where all of our streets which have crosswalks to schools, we're trying to put flashing lights there also so that people are aware that when our children are crossing the streets as traversing their school, that they will slow down. So we are trying a multiple approach as far as trying to help make our roadways safer, not only for pedestrians, but people in their vehicles. The Vision Zero program is an offshoot, and many of these pedestrian safety features and others are part of the Vision Zero program. The Vision Zero program really is no more fatalities on our highways. Zero fatalities. Whether they're pedestrians or automobile related, we want to get to a point where one day we can report no fatalities on our roadways throughout the county of Maui and the state of Hawaii. And so with that being said, these ideas about putting the plastic deflectors and the signs and flashing crosswalks and raised crosswalks are all part of the effort to reduce and to one day eliminate any fatalities on our roadways. Now, another thing I've promoted in our school zones is raised crosswalks. Raised crosswalks forces the driver to slow down because now it's like a speed impediment, but it also raises the level of the student or the child crossing the street by about 6 to 8 inches, okay, because it's raised up above the grade of the roadway itself. And so now when the child or any pedestrian traverses the crosswalk, they're at a higher level. In other words, you see them at a higher level. Also, you have to slow down because that crosswalk is raised and you can't, you know, if you go too fast, you'll damage your vehicle. It's a whole package with the Vision Zero program. And I'm putting everything together and trying to make every accommodation to stop traffic or slow down traffic and prevent pedestrian and other fatalities on our roadways. Every one of us has a responsibility, whether you're a pedestrian, whether you're a driver, it doesn't make a difference. We all have a responsibility, or a kuleana, if you want to use that term, to be aware of what's around us. Drive defensively. When you enter a crosswalk, make sure you look both ways. Make sure you get eye contact with the drivers in the cars that are approaching you so that you know they know you're there. There's so many other aspects of safe driving and safe pedestrian crossings. We, the people, must take first action and be aware and be the ones to exercise caution. And then, secondly, we in the government must continue to make these areas as safe as possible so that when you do have to cross, you can cross safely.
That was Maui Mayor Mike Victorino. And across the islands, lawmakers are attempting to address another of Hawaii's roadway dangers, that's drunk driving. With the passage of House Bill 703, now called Act 169, drivers charged with DUIs will now face stricter penalties and longer sentences. In a recent press conference, HPD Police Captain Ben Moskowitz laid out how the new law will impact Hawaii's roads.
So since July 1st, when the House Bill 703 became effective, one of the important aspects is that it changed the status of habitual DUI offenders, or OVUI offenders. Previously, before this legislation passed, you needed 3 prior convictions and your 4th strike became a felony within 10 years. So this law changed that, and now 2 prior convictions qualifies you as a habitual operator. So if you're a habitual operator and you're caught again driving under the influence, now your 3rd strike becomes a C felony charge. So normally on a typical month, we see anywhere from 4 to 6 or 7 habitual DUIs under the old structure. Under the new structure, we actually had 3 on the same day within 2 weeks of the bill passing. So we saw about a 100% uptick in the number of habitual DUI offenders. So this is important because as a 3rd offense in the prior structure, the case would basically be a petty misdemeanor case. It's not something where people would be subject to probation. It's not something where the court could order any type of alcohol abstinence or alcohol monitoring. But now as a felony case, the case is paid a little bit more attention to. The subject of the arrest would be qualify for a probation. They could qualify maybe for different alcohol and drug abuse treatments that hopefully would keep them from becoming a 4th offender and a 5th offender. So from our perspective, one of the very important aspects of this House bill that became law was that we've lowered the threshold for felony DUIs. And while that might sound draconian or harsh, in actuality, it hopefully will help some of these folks from continuing to reoffend in the future.
Traffic-related deaths, many of them related to drunk driving, have risen 18% since last year.
Jazz musicians get maximum volume before the days of amplification? That's what drives the sound of Gypsy Jazz. Hear for yourself on Saturday, August 3rd, when Gypsy 808 plays HPR's Atherton Studio. The group combines Gypsy Jazz with blues and Hawaiian swing. For tickets, visit hprtickets.org, sponsored by Amoresco.
Honolulu Civil Beat brings us our reality check as a critical deadline on a vacation rental law looms. Political and opinion editor Chad Blair joins us this morning. Hi, Chad.
Well, hi, Catherine. It's an Aloha Friday to you today.
Yes. Aren't we happy about that?
Finally.
So tell us about this. The letters warning folks, don't do it.
Well, it's finally happening. You know, gosh, we've been talking about short-term vacation rentals, illegal ones for gosh, a long time now. And as you know, the other counties have been acting. The state has tried to do something. But here, the city and county is finally following up on that bill that passed, I think it was last month, Bill 89, might have been even earlier this month. Time seems to go by. But the important date to keep in mind is August 1st. I think that's next Thursday. And the mayor, Kirk Caldwell, held a press conference at the Frank Fossey Municipal Building, along with Kathy Shokugawa. She runs Department of Planning and Permitting, to say, hey, guess what? We have sent out letters to 5,000 people, to owners suspected of running these short-term vacation rentals, letting them know that, hey, you're going to be in trouble unless you comply with the law. So it's not a violation that was sent out, but it was a warning letter to hopefully, as the mayor said, change the behavior of people that are operating illegal short-term vacation rentals.
You know, when I called the department last week, I was told by the office that they've been fielding lots of calls from people
Yes.
who are scared.
Yeah, actually, yeah, and Christina Jedra's story today, and she's our City Hall reporter, she said that there's been at least 100, I'll describe them as hate calls, from rental owners saying, what are you trying to do here? But the reality is this is the law. And now with this new law in place, folks at DPP are going and using hosting platforms like Airbnb to enforce this law. They're trying to find out where these folks are. Without Bill 89 passed into law, you really didn't have that enforcement ability. You really would have had to have stake out places that were suspected of being illegal operations. And that can be, as you can imagine, very taxing in terms of resources. But now you have this law in effect where people can go with some knowledge, some awareness, meeting the city of where these places are to try and crack down. The mayor even suggested that they might even bring an outside party, a third party in to help them with this, because as you can imagine, scanning those ads online could be very time consuming.
Yes, and you know, we had Kathy Sokugawa in our studios here, and Maui's planning director was talking about what they do, because they have a third party vendor that they've got hired to screen the ads. And they said the reason they did that was because there's technology that can block IP addresses, yes, from Hawaii from looking at those ads. And Kathy Sokugawa's eyes kind of got big, and she took some notes. So it was interesting to see that.
Yeah, well, as Christina reports, I mean, this is a $10,000 a day fine once they are found to be in violations. That's a pretty hefty amount of money for someone to fork over. The idea is to get these owners of these units to either sell their property or to make sure that it's registered for the long term, in other words, beyond 30 days. And it's a wake-up call for a lot of folks, but in addition to people concerned about their neighborhoods, we've reported on this, people in the North Shore, people in places like Kailua, Waimanalo, worried about all these people coming in and staying and filling up the parking lots. The idea is also to try and help collect some revenue. Remember,
right,
there are taxes that need to be paid, and there's a big concern that the state and the counties may be missing out on a lot of revenue, GET, TAT, so forth.
Yeah, and I believe the state tax office, they've got a court date coming up in a second attempt to try and collect taxes from folks. But, you know, I know that in talking with DPP last week, they were, mm-hmm, saying some of these owners were asking, you know, why don't you give me a break? You know, cut us some slack.
No, there's not going to be any breaks. I think Kathy Sokugawa made that very clear, that this is the law now. By the way, in Christina's story that's up on our website right now, we've actually embedded the letter that was sent out. So if people want to know what that letter says, they can take a look at it. It's really a courtesy letter. There's another deadline we should also remind people of, besides that August 1st. Deadline. There's the October 2020 deadline. That's when there will be 1,700 short-term units that will be legalized, but it'll be done through a lottery. It's going to be limited to a certain number for various areas on Oahu. And most importantly, the owner has to live there as well. So that is on the horizon. But in the meantime, the August 1st deadline is on the near horizon.
Yeah, and I'm sure the neighborhoods will be on alert to see you know, what the activity is that's going on in their neighborhoods.
Yeah, I would imagine a few calls to DPP saying, hey, have you checked out so-and-so?
Yeah, I know. I think we've got two new houses coming up in my neck of the woods, four bedrooms, eight bathrooms. And so you're like, yeah, go figure.
Who's staying there, I wonder?
All right, thanks so much, Chad.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was political and opinion editor Chad Blair with today's Reality Check. To read the full story, visit civilbeat.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Paiko, located in Kaka'ako, a botanical boutique with fresh local flowers, plants, and workshops celebrating Hawaii's nature. Now offering delivery, paikohawaii.com.
Hawaii is said to be the endangered species capital of the world, and this week we've been spotlighting a number of projects, from efforts to protect our coral reefs to our native birds. They were showcased in the recent Hawaii Conservation Conference held at the Convention Center. And this morning, HPR's Ku'uwe Hiraishi joins us to talk about what else that was rolled out that was a first for the islands.
That's right. Aloha, Catherine. At the Hawaii Conservation Conference, we've always reported here at Hawaii Public Radio on sort of the growth of Olelo Hawaii or Hawaiian language in various sort of honuas or grounds, so businesses, the courts, and even in schools. But for this one, yet another grounds for the growth of Olelo Hawaii in the conservation field. So folks working with endangered species, I mean, the variety of folks that were up on this panel, which was conducted entirely in Hawaiian, ranged from folks that were working with the environment to folks that were working with endangered species or even with communities on trying to rebuild things like ancient fish ponds. And so it was interesting to see for me, because the Olelo Hawaii community is very tight-knit. You kind of know who's going to be doing these panels. But for this particular panel, the initial flyer that went out, I didn't recognize anyone. And I started calling around. Usually there are certain institutions that will promote or advocate for these kinds of panels at different conferences. But no one was really involved. So it's really a grassroots effort on the part of folks in the conservation field to take up the effort to just, you know, try to do it themselves. So got to speak to Pua'ala Pasqua. She's a biodiversity scientist over at the American Museum of Natural History in New York. And she organized this panel and tried to get folks together initially. I think three panelists were on the initial agenda, and then they added eight on that day.
That's
because
great.
Folks had heard that, you know, this is something that's going on. But she has sort of, she's come across a lot of other indigenous communities around the world through her work. She travels a lot, and she'd be in instances where she's interfacing with them and they have a translator. And she thought, why not have this as part of our experience at the conservation conference? So here's what she had to say.
Wakapa ia keia panela o ola ka olelo a no upono I ina ikaika ina na vali vali keho ikine.
So she was talking about basically how the name of the conference was Ola Ko'olelo, which means the language is living. And so there were different, like I said earlier, various levels of proficiency in Olelo Hawaii. There were folks that I had known all my life that I didn't realize had studied a little Hawaiian and decided to just get up there and talk about their experience. And she was saying, you know, and whether there were hema hema or sort of mistakes said or misuse of words, the main thing was that everyone was up there sort of showing that Hawaiian language was something that they use in their daily work, which was interesting. So there were more than, my estimate was probably about 150 people wow. in attendance in this session. It was 2 hours, and most of them had these portable translation devices, so headsets, and they were able to listen to the Hawaiian but also have a translator in their ear, which is something that for on-the-spot translations is a challenge in and of itself. So I got to speak to the man who was tasked with that day, Noa Ha'alilio Solomon, professor up at UH, who teaches Hawaiian language, but also the president of the Ahui Olelo Hawaii, which is this organization that's dedicated to perpetuating Hawaiian language. And he talked about sort of, you know, it's hard, one, to keep up with the speakers because they were speaking so fast. So throughout that two-hour session, you had him sort of going up and saying, hold on, slow down. I need to translate for you. But also just being able to translate concepts, Hawaiian concepts into English, gets lost in translation. So he gives us an example of something that he kind of had a hard time with during that session.
Moni, oye kahimia, pehela unuhia ya moni, maka Hawaii nani hoika.
He's talking about the word moni, which in English, the literal translation would be to swallow or to ingest. But in the case of Hawaiian use of the word, during the session, the speaker was talking about sort of this hunger and feeding the hunger to speak Hawaiian to her kids and making sure that they have a taste of that. So when he was translating, he ended up using words like uptake or appreciate or receive instead of swallow, which would just sound weird to, I guess, the English-speaking ear. But, you know, there are these challenges in that, I think, growing pains with the olelo is something we will see. We do know that this year is the United Nations International Year of Indigenous Language, so that was sort of a big push in terms of the relevance of having these speakers up there from various sort of subfields in conservation. Ulalia Woodside, the executive director at the Nature Conservancy of Hawaii, was in the audience, and she understands Olo Hawaii, so she did not have her portable translation device, but has been in the conservation field here in Hawaii for a very, really long time and has seen that growth. So for her, she had an idea about what this means for the conservation field.
So there've always been an interest in Hawaiian, I think in Hawaiian language, concepts, words. It's important. We've talked about Malama Aina here at the conference for many, many years. It's been a foundation of our themes and what we do. But when the language is the means by which these conservation professionals are communicating and thinking, they are bringing more than just translations of a North American conservation type of ethic and practice. They're also embodying the traditional values, the traditional practices of Malama Aina, and bringing those forward into their work.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So the interesting thing in speaking to some of these folks who were on the panel, it's this idea of there not being too much of a, I guess, culture in a box, or language being this thing that you kind of do on the side, but them bringing this into who they are as Hawaiian scientists. And we're seeing more of that. So Natalie Kurashima is a land manager out in Kona, in Kahului, on the Big Island for Kamehameha Schools. And I think 2 years ago, Kamehameha Schools implemented a policy for its employees that mandates Olelo Hawaii.
Wow.
Yeah, mandates Olelo Hawaii classes for their employees, and provides that, if, you know, for those who have been taking it. So she's, having not grown up speaking Hawaiian, has really gained a proficiency and was on the panel. But
impressive.
Her, she's, yeah, I mean, I think we're seeing, I don't think there are a lot of organizations that have implemented policies mandating it necessarily. But I think you'll see more and more organizations sort of seeing the value of having their employees exposed to Olelo Hawaii in a way that allows them to sort of understand their role in their job in Malama Aina, but also connect to sort of the ancient wisdom or inherent ancient wisdom that's embodied in it.
Well, it is one of our two official languages, right?
It is. It is. And right now, I think the U.S. Census Bureau's latest statistic was 26,000 Hawaiian language speakers of various levels of proficiency, so not all fluent necessarily. But I think that as that number grows, we'll see it more, I guess, in other areas, but in other fields. But definitely looking forward to next year's maybe a Hawaiian language panel that's done on a particular topic or something like that.
Well, we did see at the legislature they were trying to be more inclusive with that, which was positive.
Right, right. We do have several, I think, Senate, several offices do sort of put out their agenda, and Olelo Hawaii, Office of Foreign Affairs included. So it's growing, I think, with the number of speakers as well. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
And you grew up in the Hawaiian Immersion
Right.
program,
yeah.
School, right, in the schools.
Yes, and I think that's, like I said, tight-knit community. A lot of the effort, I think, in creating more speakers has come from that movement.
Well, yeah, it's fantastic. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Catherine.
That was HPR's Kuvehi Hiraishi talking about the inclusion of the Native Hawaiian language into the conservation conference that was held early this month in Honolulu. This morning, we asked you to tell us when the first successful ascent of a manned hot air balloon flight in Hawaii took place. The year was 1889 when Joseph Van Tassel took off from Kapi'olani Park on November 2nd. He rose to an altitude of 1 mile and then came back to Earth by parachute. He tried again on November 18th, taking off from Punch Bowl Crater and then tried to parachute to safety. This time, though, the wind was against him. He was carried into Kihei Lagoon and drowned before help could arrive. So although Mr. Van Tassel gained the distinction of being Hawaii's first successful flyer, its first parachutist, he also became its first air fatality. We had no winners today on this one. That is today's quiz. If you have one, send it to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. It was a weekend summer ride that drew some 200 cyclists. It started deep in Kalihi Valley on a 100-acre preserve. It was thanks to the efforts of Kokua Kalihi Valley and a little bike repair program that takes a holistic approach to teaching our keiki about resiliency and keeping healthy physically and mentally. The Kalihi Apua'a bike ride included the story of the valley.
The edge of the world, yeah. So here in Kalihi, it means the edge. And actually, there's an older name for Kalihi, which is Kalihi Lihi o Laumiha, which means the eyelashes of Laumiha. And Laumiha is one of our goddesses, Hawaiians, who actually lived in this valley. And she still lives here. For a lot of us, she still lives here. And so that's actually where that name Kalihi came from. It's Kalihi Lihi o Laumiha.
Buenwa Sitik is an intern with K-Vibe, the Kalihi Valley Instructional Bike Exchange.
I've been with this program 3 years now.
What do you think you've gotten out of this?
I learned so much. It's not all about bikes at the shop. There's also a clinic, so we help our community sometimes if we're able. So we have bad schedule, so we try our best to go out to the community to share our love and support for them.
This is an incredible turnout today.
Yeah, for sure.
So have you done this ride before?
Yeah, last year, that was my first ride.
What'd you learn about the valley?
Oh, I learned that Ainu is not just land. Aina is a land that gives back, that feeds people, and so that's what I learned from the valley.
So you take care of the Aina takes care of you.
Yes, yes.
And Dr. David DeRauf is a practicing physician and the executive director of Kokua Kalihi Valley. He's proud of the efforts of the young staff and participants in the K-Vibe program.
You know, this ride is all about community. It's about celebrating this community, the history of this community. Kalihi is a place we're all tremendously proud of and in love with, and you see that expression of love out here today. It's about community as a form of a muscle. You know, we forget that community means many things to many people, but one thing is that community is like a muscle. If you don't flex it, you lose it. And if you start flexing it, you can get that muscle strong. And so this event is one of those ways that we flex that muscle and we remember, hey, you know what, we all might be in different paths, different walks of life, different ethnicities, different languages, but we're community too. So that's the fun part of this, is people coming together, having fun, developing a shared sense of history of this place, a knowledge of it, the names of this place, the beauty of this place. Riding from mountain to ocean along that old Ahapua'a path that our ancestors here knew about. I think that's what the ride's all about.
You'll be doing story stops. Explain.
Story stops. So the ride and its content are developed by young men, primarily young men and women from the community, who take charge of this event, and they decide what is it that they want to know about the history of this place? And then when they learn that history, what is it they want to share with others? So a big part of the ride is the expression of their identities through history, through sharing, through storytelling.
So you folks are going to end up over at the Sandlot down at Sand Island.
Yep.
And have a big party down there just to celebrate this event. You also have a number of groups, I think, from the mainland that are watching to see what you're doing here.
Yeah, they're coming in. So we are one of a cohort of organizations around the country who are focused on young men's mental health. And for us, you know, the origins of good mental health in our youth, as well as our elders, starts in community. A strong community, a sense of place, a sense of history, a sense of identity. And so people are here looking at the particular flavor that we do that.
I've heard for many years about the good work that Kukuakulihi Valley does here. And, you know, we're at this wonderful preserve, really, deep in the valley. It's fabulous back here.
Yeah, we're back here at Ho'u'ulu Aina. We've been on the land here now for a bit more than a decade. Our bike program and our work on the land here started at the same time. Different expressions of the community, different expressions of love for this community. This 100 acres is thriving with the help of thousands of community members who come here on a regular basis to Malama Aina and to Aloha Aina.
One of the interns we just talked to said that he's learned it's not just about bikes, but it's about the Aina, and take care of the Aina and the Aina will take care of you.
Yeah, so the boys, I mean, a big part of their journey is on a regular basis. They come up here, they take part in reforestation efforts, in gardening, in working side by side with elders in our community. It's their shop is down in what is a pretty industrial place. It's an old warehouse, it's loud, there's a lot of tools and grease around, and then they come up here and they see a different community. For some of them, for many of them, I would say, they come up here and they say, boy, I feel at home. And maybe for some of them, that's the first time in their life that they've really felt really at home. So a lot of what we're doing here is creating a place where people feel at home.
So you're nurturing the spirit of these young men, really, these boys,
our future leaders. These are our future leaders. I am so proud to see this cohort of young men growing up, people I can really look to and say, these kids are going to lead this community someday. I mean all the way down to ages 8, who will sit in a meeting. Recently we met with the Federal Reserve Bank, and here were kids ages 8 to 18 sitting at that table with the Federal Reserve Bank and fully believing that they had a place at that table.
So it's that confidence that you're helping to nurture.
Yeah, confidence. Really, that confidence comes out of their own story of who am I, where did I come from, who are my ancestors. What was the language of my parents and grandparents? Getting them to feel proud about that. For many of them growing up, they've never known to feel proud of their ancestry. We think it's a huge thing for kids to really feel proud about who they are and where they came from.
And it's also then finding their way as they grow up in the world.
Yep, they consider themselves navigators. They navigate by bicycle instead of boat. We're also in the process of carving canoes up here, a different kind of navigation. But, you know, in many ways, it's one and the same. It's finding your way in the world.
And as we said, the ride was paired with story stops as our young teens of the valley shared the history of where they live. One story stop, the Kalihi Pueo Cemetery on School Street. It is where Joseph Kahawai, a young Hawaiian man, is buried. He, along with four others, were falsely accused of raping Thalia Massey, the wife of a military officer. Kahawai died at the hands of Massey's mother and husband. They were convicted of his killing, but served only 1 hour in jail. And it was this month, 56 years ago, that Thalia Massey committed suicide. But there are generations that don't know about that infamous Massey trial. But the young men in Kalihi Valley brought that story of a dark time of injustice and discrimination to the forefront.
I grew up in a place where the people who belong here, the people I know we stand upon right now, were discriminated against and had everything taken from them. I stand here proud of my people, who I am, and the diversity that makes me different from every one of you and yet holds us all together through the beauty of the fact that we are diverse.
And along for that ride that day, Louis Colunga. He's with a group working with young boys in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He flew in to see what ideas he could take back with him.
Our organization is called Together for Brothers. We work with young men of color, building capacity at all levels in their community, and so they can be leaders, and also to help them build community. So we've been connecting with K-Vibe for about a year now, just over Zoom calls or Google Hangouts, and each week we would get on the call and just, you know, plan until this bike ride every week, you know, just planning and connecting with each other at all different levels. You know, we started our bike program because we were inspired by K-Vibe. We employ 30 young men of color, from youth organizers to lead youth organizers, project managers, and program coordinators as well. This is just like really, really beautiful chance for us to do a lot of healing. So actually, I do healing justice work, and it's just, you know, this is great for our organization to heal together.
A documentary film crew was on hand for the summer ride. It will spotlight the program as part of Movember, a focus on men's health in the month of November. Stay tuned.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, whose contributors help Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to the St. Andrew Schools, which includes the Priory School for Girls, the Prep for Boys, and Queen Emma Preschool.
I'm Molly Webster. On the next Science Friday, we go into the woods in search of birds with a how-to guide for beginner birders. Plus, can anonymous data protect your privacy? What data points make you unique, and how anyone can find them out? That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
This afternoon from 1 to 3.
That wraps it up for today. Next week, we keep an eye on the trade talks with China that are set to resume. We'd like to hear from you. Call our talkback line. Leave your comments. Call 808-792-8217. You can also email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post your comments on Facebook at The Conversation HPR, or tweet us at HI Conversation. Find us on Instagram at The Conversation HPR. And if you want to hear today's show again, or get another past show, or links to more information, go to our conversation page on the HPR website, hawaiipublicradio.org. Our program is produced by Lillian Song, Ryan Finnerty, and Harrison Patino. The Backyard Quiz theme written for us by John DeMello. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us on Monday and pick up The Conversation.